here? Where are the representatives of the commission? Why aren't they here for this meeting? Governor Claire Paulo raised a thin hand and pointed at the flat photo in the Grand Inquisitor's hand.
There, Your Excellency. There are the commission authorities.
Cardinal Mustafa looked down at the glossy photograph. Forms of white-clad bodies could be seen in the dusty red streets of Arafat Kefia. Even through the grain of the images, it was obvious that the bodies were mauled into grotesque forms and swollen from decomposition. The Grand Inquisitor spoke softly, fighting the urge to scream and then order these imbeciles tortured and shot.
"Why?" he asked softly. "Haven't these people been resurrected and questioned?"
Archbishop Robeson actually attempted a smile.
"You will see that tomorrow, Your Excellency. It will be abundantly clear tomorrow."
EMVs were useless on Mars. They used armored pack security skimmers for their flight to Tharsis Plateau. Torch ships and the Jibril monitored their progress. Scorpion fighters flew space air combat patrol. 200 clicks from the plateau, 5 squads of Marines dropped from the skimmers and flew ahead at low altitude, raking the area with acoustic probes and setting up firing positions. Nothing but the shifting sand moved in Arafat Kefia. The Holy Office security skimmers set down first, their landing legs settling into sand where grass had once grown on the oval city commons. The outer ships establishing and linking a Class 6 containment field that made the buildings around the plaza seem to shimmer in heat haze. The Marines had dropped into a defensive circle with the commons as their locus. Now the governor's packs and home guard troops moved out to establish a second perimeter in the streets and alleys around the plaza. The archbishop's 8 Swiss guardsmen secured the circle just outside the containment field. Finally, the Grand Inquisitor's Holy Office security force exploded down the skimmer ramps and established the inner perimeter of kneeling figures in black combat armor.
"Claire,"
came the leading Marine sergeant's voice on the tactical channel.
"Nothing moving or alive within a kilometer of Site 1,"
rasped the lieutenant of the Home Guard.
"Bodies in the street."
"Clear here,"
said the captain of the Swiss Guard.
"Confirm nothing moving in Arafat Kefia except your people,"
came the voice of the captain of the Jibril.
"Affirmative,"
said Holy Office Security Commander Browning. Feeling foolish and disgruntled, the Grand Inquisitor swept down the ramp and across the sandy commons. His mood was not lifted by the silly osmosis mask he had to wear, its circular boosterator slung over his shoulder like a loose medallion. Father Farrell, Archbishop Robeson, Governor Paulo, and a host of functionaries ran to keep up as Cardinal Mustafa strode by the kneeling security forms and, with an imperious wave of his hand, ordered a portal cut in the containment field. He passed through over the protests of Commander Browning and the other forms in black armor who were scuttling to catch up.
"Where is the first of..."
began the Grand Inquisitor as he bounced down the narrow alley opposite the commons. He still was not used to the light gravity here.
"Right around this corner,"
panted the Archbishop.
"We should really wait for the outer fields to be," said Governor Paulo.
"Here," said Father Farrell, pointing down the street onto which they had emerged. The group of 15 stopped so quickly that those aides and security people in the rear had to catch themselves before bumping into the VIPs in front.
"Dear Lord,"
whispered Archbishop Robeson and crossed himself. Through the clear osmosis mask, his face was visibly white.
"Christ,"
muttered Governor Claire Paulo.
"I've seen the hollows and photos for 2 weeks, but Christ."
"Ah," said Father Farrell, taking a step closer to the first body. The Grand Inquisitor joined him. He went to one knee in the red sand. The contorted form in the dirt looked as if someone had fashioned an abstract sculpture out of flesh, bone, and gristle. It would not have been recognizably human had it not been for the teeth gleaming in the wide-stretched mouth and one hand lying nearby in the shifting Martian dust. After a moment, the Grand Inquisitor said,
"Did scavengers do some or most of this? carrion birds, perhaps, rats?
Negative, said Major Piet, the governor's Pax Fleet ground force commander. No birds on the Tharsis Plateau since the atmosphere started thinning 2 centuries ago. No rats or any other moving thing have been picked up by motion detectors since this happened.
The Shrike did this, said the Grand Inquisitor.
He did not sound convinced. He stood and moved to the second body. It might have been a woman. It looked as if it had been turned inside out and shredded.
And this?
We think so, said Governor Paolo. The militia that found all this brought out the security camera which had that 38-second hollow we've shown you.
That looked like a dozen shrikes killing a dozen people, said Father Farrell. It was hazy. There was a sandstorm, said Major Piet, and there was only one shrike. We've studied the individual images. It simply moved through the crowd so quickly that it appeared to be multiple creatures.
Moved through the crowd, murmured the Grand Inquisitor. He stepped over a third body that might have been a child or small female. Doing this.
Doing this, said Governor Paolo.
She glanced at Archbishop Robeson, who had moved to a wall for support. There were 20 to 30 bodies in this section of the street. Father Farrell knelt and ran his gloved hand across the chest and into the chest cavity of the first cadaver. The flesh was frozen, as was the blood that fell in a black icefall.
And there was no sign of the cruciform, he said softly.
Governor Paolo shook her head.
Not in the 2 bodies the militia returned for resurrection. No sign of the cruciform whatsoever. If there had been any remnant at all, even a millimeter of note or bit of fiber in the brainstem or...
We know that, snapped the Grand Inquisitor, ending the explanation.
Very strange, said Bishop Erdl, the Holy Office's expert on resurrection technique. To my knowledge, there has never been an instance where the body was left so intact, where we could not find remnant of the cruciform in the corpse. Governor Paolo is correct, of course. Even the slightest bit of cruciform is all that is necessary for the sacrament of resurrection.
The Grand Inquisitor stopped to inspect a body that had been thrown against an iron railing hard enough to impale it at 12 points. It looks as if the Shrike was after the cruciforms. It tore every shred of them out of the bodies.
Not possible, said Bishop Erdl. Simply not possible. There are over 500 meters of microfiber in the cellular node extensions of...
Not possible, agreed the Grand Inquisitor. But when we ship these bodies back, I'll wager that none are recoverable. The Shrike may have torn their hearts and lungs and throats out, but it was after their cruciforms. Security Commander Browning came around the corner with 5 troopers in black armor.
Your Excellency?
He said on the tactical channel only the Grand Inquisitor could hear.
The worst is a block over. This way.
The entourage followed the man in black armor, but slowly, reluctantly. They catalogued 362 bodies. Many were in the streets, but the majority were in buildings in the city or inside the sheds, hangars, and spacecraft at the new spaceport on the edge of Arafat Kefia. Hollows were taken, and the Holy Office forensic teams took over, recording each site before taking the bodies back to the Pax Base morgue outside of St. Malachy. It was determined that all of the bodies were off-worlders, i.e., there were no local Palestinians or native Martians among them. The spaceport intrigued the Pax Fleet experts the most.
8 dropships serving the field itself, said Major Piet. That's a serious number. St. Malachy's spaceport uses only 2.
He glanced up at the purple Martian sky.
Assuming that the ships they were shuttling to and from had their own dropships, at least 2 each if they were freighters, then we're talking about serious logistics here.
The Grand Inquisitor looked at Mars's Archbishop, but Robeson merely held his hands up.
We knew nothing of these operations, said the little man. As I explained before, it was an Opus Dei project.
Well, said the Grand Inquisitor. As far as we can tell, all of the Opus Dei personnel are dead. Truly, irrecoverably dead. So now it's a responsibility of the Holy Office.
You don't have any idea what they built this port for? Heavy metals, perhaps? Some sort of mineral mining operation?
Governor Paulo shook her head.
This world has been mined for over 1,000 years. There are no heavy metals left worth shipping. No minerals worth a local salvage operation's time, much less Opus Dei's.
Major Piet slipped his visor up and rubbed the stubble on his chin.
Something was being shipped in quantity here, Your Excellencies. 8 dropships, a sophisticated grid system, automated security.
If the Shrike, or whatever it was, had not destroyed the computers and record systems, began Commander Browning.
Major Piet shook his head.
It wasn't the Shrike. The computers had already been destroyed by shaped charges and tailored DNA viruses.
He looked around the empty administrative building. Red sand had already found its way in through portals and seams.
It's my guess that these people destroyed their own records before the Shrike arrived. I think they were on the verge of clearing out. That's why the dropships were all in pre-launch mode, their onboard computers set to go.
Father Farrell nodded. But all we have are the orbital coordinates. No records of who or what they were going to rendezvous with there. Major Piet looked out the window at the dust storm blowing there.
There are 20 ground car buses in that lot, he murmured as if speaking to himself. Each one can transport up to 80 people. A bit of logistical overkill if the Opus Dei contingent here amounted to just the 360-some people whose bodies we found.
Governor Paulo frowned and crossed her arms. We don't know how many Opus Dei personnel were here, Major. As you pointed out, the records were destroyed. Perhaps there were thousands. Commander Browning stepped into the circle of VIPs.
Begging your pardon, Governor, but the barracks within the field perimeter here could house about 400 people. I think that the Major may be right. All of the Opus Dei personnel may be accounted for in the bodies we found.
You can't be sure of that, Commander, said Governor Paulo, her voice sounding displeased.
No, ma'am.
She gestured toward the dust storm that had all but obscured the parked buses. And we have evidence that they needed transport for many more people.
Perhaps they were an advance contingent, said Commander Browning, preparing the way for a much larger population.
Then why destroy the records and limited AIs, said Major Piet. Why does it look like they were preparing to move out for good?
The Grand Inquisitor stepped into the circle and held up one black-gloved hand.
We'll end the speculation for now. The Holy Office will begin taking depositions and carrying out interrogations tomorrow. Governor, may we use your office at the palace?
Of course, Your Excellency.
Paulo lowered her face, either to show deference or to hide her eyes, or both.
Very good, said the Grand Inquisitor. Commander, Major, call the skimmers. We'll leave the forensic teams and the morgue workers out here.
Cardinal Mustafa peered out at the worsening storm. Its howl could be heard through the 10 layers of window plastic now.
What's the local word for this dust storm?
Simoom, said Governor Paulo.
The storms used to cover the entire world. They're growing in intensity every Martian year.
The locals say that it's the old Martian gods, whispered Archbishop Robeson. They're reclaiming their own.
Less than 14 light-years out from Old Earth System, above the world called Vitus Gray Balianus B, a starship that had once been named Raphael but which now held no name, finished its braking run into geosynchronous orbit. The 4 living things on board floated in zero-G, their gazes fixed on the image of the desert world on the plot board.
How reliable is our reading on perturbations in the Farcaster field these days, said the female named Scylla.
More reliable than most other clues, said her seeming twin, Radamanth Nemes. We'll check it out.
Shall we start with one of the Pax bases? Said the male named Gyges.
The largest, said Nemes.
That would be Pax Base Bombacino, said Briareus, checking the code on the plot board. Northern Hemisphere, along the Central Canal route, population of...
It doesn't matter what the population is, interrupted Radamanth Nemes.
It just matters whether the child Ania and the android and that bastard Endymion have come that way.
Dropships prepped, said Scylla.
They screeched into atmosphere, extended wings just as they crossed the Terminator, used the Vatican Disky code via transponder to clear the way for their landing, and set down amid Scorpions, troopship skimmers, and armored EMVs. A flustered lieutenant greeted them and escorted them to the base commander's office.
"You say that you're members of the Noble Guard?" said Commander Solznikov,
studying their faces and the readout on the Disky interface at the same time.
"We have said it," Radamanth Nemes replied tonelessly. "Our papers, order chips, and Disky have said it. How many repetitions do you require, Commander?"
Solznikov's face and neck reddened above the high collar of his tunic. He looked down at the interface hollow instead of replying. Technically, these Noble Guard officers, members of one of the Pope's exotic new units, could pull rank on him. Technically, they could have him shot or excommunicated, since their ranks of cohort leaders in the Noble Guard combined the powers of both Pax Fleet and the Vatican. Technically, according to the wording and priority encryption of the Disky, they could pull rank on a planetary governor or dictate church policy to a world's presiding archbishop. Technically, Solznikov wished these pale freaks had never shown up on his backwater world. The commander forced a smile.
"Our forces here are at your disposal. What can I do for you?"
The thin, pale woman named Nemes held a holo card over the commander's desk and activated it. Suddenly, the life-size heads of three people floated in the space between them, or rather two people, since the third face was obviously that of a blue-skinned android.
"I didn't think that there were any androids left in the Pax," said Solznikov.
"Have you had reports of any of these three in your territory, Commander?" said Nemes, ignoring his question. "It is probable that they would have been reported along the major river which runs from your north pole to the equator."
"It's actually a canal," began Solznikov and stopped.
None of the four looked as if they had any interest in small talk or extraneous information. He called his aide, Colonel Venara, into the office.
"Their names?"
said Solznikov, as Venara stood poised with his comm log ready. Nemes gave three names that meant nothing to the commander.
"Those aren't local names," he said as Colonel Venara checked records. "Members of the indigenous culture, it's called the Amoeti Spectrum Helix, tend to accumulate names the way my hunting dog back on Potoffa collected ticks. You see, they have this triune marriage arrangement where..."
"These are not locals," interrupted Nemes.
Her thin lips looked as bloodless as the rest of her pale face above the red uniform collar. "They're off-worlders."
"Ah, well," said Solznikov, relieved that he would not be dealing with these Noble Guard freaks for more than a minute or two more. "Then we can't help you. You see, Bombacino's the only working spaceport on Vitus Gray Balianus B, now that we closed down the indigene operation at Koroa Tambat. And except for a few spacers who end up in our brig, there's no immigration at all here. The locals are all Spectrum Helix, and, well, they like colors, they surely do, but an android would stand out like a... Well, Colonel?"
Colonel Venara looked up from his database search.
"Neither the images nor names match anything in our records, except for an all-points bulletin sent through via Pax Fleet about 4.5 standard years ago."
He looked questioningly at the Noble Guardsman. Nemes and her siblings stared back without comment. Commander Solznikov spread his hands.
"I'm sorry. We've been busy for the last local 2 weeks on a major training exercise I had running here, but if anyone had come through here who matched these descriptions..."
"Sir," said Colonel Venara, "there were those four runaway spacers."
"God damn it," thought Solznikov. To the Noble Guardsman, he said, "Four mercantilist spacers who jumped ship rather than face charges for use of illegal drugs. As I remember it, they were all men, all in their 60s, and..."
He turned significantly to Colonel Venara, trying to tell him to shut the fuck up with his gaze and tone.
"And we found their bodies in the Big Greasy, didn't we, Colonel?"
"Three bodies, sir," said Colonel Venara, oblivious to his commander's signals. He was checking the database again.
"One of our skimmers went down near Koroa Tambat, and Med dispatched a..."
Dr. Abney Molina to go down canal with a missionary to care for the injured crew.
What the hell does this have to do with anything, Colonel? Snapped Solznikov. These officers are searching for a teenager, a man in his 30s, and an android.
Yes, sir, said Venara, looking up, startled, from his comm log. But Dr. Molina radioed in that she had treated a sick off-worlder in locked child Lamond. We assumed that it was the fourth spacer.
Radamanth Nemes took a step forward so quickly that Commander Solznikov flinched involuntarily. There was something about the slim woman's movements that was not quite human.
"Where is Lockchild Lamond?"
demanded Nemes.
"It's just a village along the canal, about 80 clicks south of here," said Solznikov.
He turned to Colonel Venara as if all this commotion were his aide's fault.
"When are they flying the prisoner back?"
"Tomorrow morning, sir. We have a med skimmer scheduled to pick up the crew in Karoa Tambad at 0600 hours, and they'll stop in."
The colonel stopped speaking as the four noble guard officers spun on their heels and made for the door. Nemes paused just long enough to say,
"Commander, clear our flight path between here and this Lockchild Lamond. We'll be taking the dropship."
That's not necessary," said the commander, checking the screen on his desk. "The spacer is under arrest and will be delivered. Hey!"
The four noble guard officers had clattered down the steps outside his office and were crossing the tarmac. Solznikov rushed out onto the landing and shouted after them.
"Dropships aren't allowed to operate in atmosphere here except to land at Bombacino. Hey! We'll send a skimmer! Hey! This spacer's almost certainly not one of your... He's under guard! Hey!"
The four did not look back as they reached their ship, ordered an escalator to morph down to them, and disappeared through the dropship hull. Sirens went off across the base and personnel ran for shelter as the heavy dropship lifted on thrusters, shifted to EM, and accelerated south across the port perimeter.
"Jesus fucking Christ," whispered Commander Solznikov.
"Pardon me, sir," said Colonel Venara.
Solznikov gave him a glare that would have melted lead.
"Dispatch 2 combat skimmers immediately. No, make that 3. I want a squad of Marines aboard each skimmer. This is our turf, and I don't want these anemic noble guard pissants doing so much as littering without our say-so. I want the skimmers there first, and that fucking spacer taken into custody. Our custody. If it means hair-lipping every Spectrum Helix indigene between here and Lockchild Lamond. Savvy, Colonel?"
Venara could only stare at his commander.
"Move!"
shouted Commander Solznikov. Colonel Venara moved. Chapter 10. I was awake all that long night and the next day, writhing in pain, shuttling to the bathroom while carrying my IV drip apparatus, trying painfully to urinate, and then checking the absurd filter I had to urinate through for any sign of the kidney stone that was killing me. Sometime in late morning, I passed the thing. For a minute, I couldn't believe it. The pain had been less for the past half hour or so, just the echo of pain in my back and groin, actually. But as I stared at the tiny reddish thing in the filter cone, something larger than a grain of sand but much smaller than a pebble, I couldn't believe that it could have caused such agony for so many hours.
"Believe it," Ania said as she sat on the edge of the counter and watched me pull my pajama shirt back in place. "It's often the smallest things in life that cause us the greatest pain." "Yeah," I said. I knew vaguely that Ania was not there, that I would never have urinated in front of anyone like that, much less in front of this girl. I had been hallucinating her presence ever since the first ultramorph injection.
"Congratulations," said the Ania hallucination.
Her smile seemed real enough, that slightly mischievous, slightly teasing turning up of the right side of her mouth that I'd grown accustomed to. And I could see that she was wearing the green denim slacks and white cotton shirt she often wore when working in the desert heat. But I could also see the sink basin and soft towels through her.
"Thanks," I said, and shuffled back to collapse in the bed. I could not believe that the pain would not return. In fact, Dr. Molina had said that there might be several stones. Ania was gone when Demria, Demloa, and the trooper on guard came into the room.
Oh, it's wonderful, said Demria.
We're so glad, said Demloa.
We hope that you would not have to go to the Pax infirmary for surgery.
Put your right hand up here, said the trooper.
He handcuffed me to the brass headboard.
I'm a prisoner, I said groggily. You always have been, grunted the trooper.
His dark skin was sweaty under his helmet visor.
The skimmer will be by tomorrow morning to pick you up. Wouldn't want you missing the ride.
He went back out to the shade of the barrel tree out front.
Ah, said Demloa, touching my handcuffed wrist with her cool fingers.
We are sorry, Roland Dimion.
It's not your fault, I said, feeling so tired and drugged that my tongue did not want to work right.
You've been nothing but kind. So kind.
The fading pain kept me from sleeping.
Father Clifton would like to come in and speak with you. Would that be all right?
At that moment, I would have welcomed spider rats nibbling on my toes about as much as the idea of chatting with a missionary priest. I said,
Sure, why not?
Father Clifton was younger than I, short, but not as short as Demria or Demloa or her race, and pudgy, with thinning sandy hair receding from his friendly, flushed face. I thought that I knew his type. There had been a chaplain in the home guard a bit like Father Clifton, earnest, mostly inoffensive, a bit of a mama's boy, who may have gone into the priesthood so that he would never have to grow up and become really responsible for himself. It was Grandam who had pointed out to me how the parish priests in the various moor-end villages on Hyperion tended to remain somewhat childlike, treated with deference by their parishioners, fussed over by housekeepers and women of all ages, never in real competition with other adult males. I don't think that Grandam was actively anti-clerical, in spite of her refusal to accept the cross, just amused by this tendency of parish priests in the great and powerful Pax Empire. Father Clifton wanted to discuss theology. I think that I moaned then, but it must have been taken for a reaction to the kidney stone, for the good priest merely leaned closer, patted my arm, and murmured, There, there, my son. Did I mention that he was at least 5 or 6 years younger than me?
Rawl. May I call you Rawl?
Sure, Father. I closed my eyes as if falling asleep.
What is your opinion of the church, Rawl?
Under my eyelids, I rolled my eyes.
The church, Father?
Father Clifton waited.
I shrugged. Or to be more precise, I tried to shrug. It's not that easy when one wrist is handcuffed above your head and the other arm is on the receiving end of an intravenous drip.
Father Clifton must have understood my awkward motion.
You're indifferent to it, then?
He asked softly.
As indifferent as one can be to an organization that's tried to capture or kill me, I thought.
Not indifferent, Father, I said.
It's just that the church... Well, it hasn't always been relevant to my life in most ways.
One of the missionary's sandy eyebrows rose slightly.
Gosh, Rawl, the church is a lot of things, not all of them spotlessly good, I'm sure.
But I hardly think that it could be accused of being irrelevant.
I considered shrugging again, but decided one awkward spasm of that sort was enough.
I see what you mean, I said, hoping that the conversation was over.
Father Clifton leaned even closer, his elbows on his knees, his hands set together in front of him, but more in the aspect of persuasion and reason than prayer.
Rawl, you know that they're taking you back to base Bombacino in the morning.
I nodded. My head was still free to move.
You know that the Pax fleet and Mercantila's punishment for desertion is death.
Yeah, I said, but only after a fair trial. Father Clifton ignored my sarcasm. His brow was wrinkled with what could only be worry, although for my fate or for my eternal soul, I was not sure which.
Perhaps for both. For Christians, he began and paused a moment. For Christians, such an execution is punishment, some discomfort, perhaps even momentary terror. But then they mend their ways and go on with their lives. For you...
Nothingness, I said, helping him end his sentence. The big gulp,
Eternal darkness. Nada ness. I become a worm's casserole.
Father Clifton was not amused.
This does not have to be the case, my son.
I sighed and looked out the window. It was early afternoon on Vitis Gray Balianus B. The sunlight was different here than on worlds that I had known well. Hyperion, Old Earth, even Mare Infinitus and other places I had visited briefly but intensely. But the difference was so subtle that I would have found it hard to describe. But it was beautiful. There was no arguing that. I looked at the cobalt sky streaked with violet clouds, at the butter-rich light falling on pink adobe and the wooden sill. I listened to the sound of children playing in the alley, to the soft conversation of Cess Ambry and her sick brother Bin, to the sudden soft laughter as something in the game they were playing amused them, and I thought, to lose all this forever? And I hallucinated Aenea's voice saying, to lose all this forever is the essence of being human, my love. Father Clifton cleared his throat. Have you ever heard of Pascal's Wagerol?
Yes.
You have? Father Clifton sounded surprised. I had the feeling that I had thrown him off stride in his prepared line of argument. Then you know why it makes sense, he said rather lamely. I sighed again. The pain was steady now, not coming and going in the tidal surges that had overwhelmed me the past few days. I remembered first encountering Blaise Pascal in conversations with Grandam when I was a kid, then discussing him with Aenea in the Arizona twilight, and finally looking up his Pensée in the excellent library at Taliesin West. Pascal was a mathematician, Father Clifton was saying, pre-Hegira, mid-18th century, I think.
Actually, he lived in the mid-1600s, I said, 1623 to 1662, I think.
Actually, I was bluffing a bit on the dates. The numbers seemed right, but I would not have bet my life on them. I remembered the era because Aenea and I had spent a couple of weeks one winter discussing the Enlightenment and its effect on people and institutions pre-Hegira, pre-Pax.
Yes, said Father Clifton. But the time he lived isn't as important as his so-called wager. Consider it, Rawl. On one side, the chance of resurrection, immortality, an eternity in heaven and benefiting from Christ's light. On the other side, how did you put it?
The big gulp, I said.
Nadanes.
Worse than that, said the young priest, his voice thick with earnest conviction. Nada means nothingness, sleep without dreams. But Pascal realized that the absence of Christ's redemption is worse than that. It's eternal regret, longing, infinite sadness.
And hell? I said. Eternal punishment?
Father Clifton squeezed his hands together, obviously uncomfortable at that side of the equation.
Perhaps, he said. But even if hell were just eternal recognition of the chances one has lost, why risk that? Pascal realized that if the church was wrong, nothing would be lost by embracing its hope, and if it was right?
I smiled.
A bit cynical, isn't it, Father?
The priest's pale eyes looked directly into mine.
Not as cynical as going to your death for no reason, Rawl. Not when you can accept Christ as your Lord, do good works among other human beings, serve your community and your brothers and sisters in Christ, and save your physical life and your immortal soul in the process.
I nodded. After a minute, I said,
maybe the time he lived was important.
Father Clifton blinked, not following me.
Blaise Pascal, I mean, I said.
He lived through an intellectual revolution, the likes of which humanity has rarely seen. On top of that, Copernicus and Kepler and their ilk were opening up the universe a thousandfold. The sun was becoming, well, just a sun, Father. Everything was being displaced, moved aside, shoved from the center. Pascal once said, I am terrified by the eternal silence of these infinite spaces. Father Clifton leaned closer. I could smell the soap and shaving cream scent on his smooth skin.
All the more reason to consider the wisdom of his wager, Rawl.
I blinked, wanting to move away from the pink and freshly scrubbed moon of a face. I was afraid that I smelled of sweat and pain and fear. I had not brushed my teeth in 24 hours. I don't think that I want to make any wager, if it means dealing with a church that has grown so corrupt that it makes obedience and submission the price of its saving the life of someone's child, I said. Father Clifton pulled away as if slapped. His fair skin flushed a deeper red. Then he stood and patted my arm. You get some sleep. We'll speak again before you leave tomorrow. But I did not have until tomorrow. If I had been outside at that moment, looking at just the precise quadrant of the late afternoon sky, I would have seen the scratch of flame across the dome of cobalt as Nemes's dropship entered the landing pattern for Pax Base Bombacino. When Father Clifton left, I fell asleep. I watched as Ania and I sat in the vestibule of her shelter in the desert night and continued our conversation. I've had this dream before, I said, looking around and touching the stone beneath the canvas of her shelter. The rock still held some of the day's heat. Yes, said Ania. She was sipping from a fresh cup of tea. You are going to tell me the secret that makes you the Messiah, I heard myself say. The secret which makes you the bond between two worlds that the AI Uman spoke of. Yes, said my young friend and nodded again. But first tell me if you think that your reply to Father Clifton was adequate. Adequate? I shrugged. I was angry. Ania sipped tea. Steam rose from the cup and touched her lashes. But you didn't really respond to his question about Pascal's wager. That was all the response I needed to give, I said, somewhat irritated. Little Binria Dem Loa Alem is dying of cancer. The church uses their cruciform as leverage. That's corrupt, foul. I'll have none of it. Ania looked at me over the steaming cup. But if the church were not corrupt, Rawl, if it offered the cruciform without price or reservation, would you accept it? No. The immediacy of my answer surprised me. The girl smiled. So it is not the corruption of the church that is at the heart of your objection. You reject resurrection itself. I started to speak, hesitated, frowned, and then rephrased what I was thinking. This kind of resurrection I reject, yes. Still smiling, Ania said. Is there another kind? The church used to think so, I said. For almost 3,000 years, the resurrection it offered was of the soul, not the body. And do you believe in that other kind of resurrection? No, I said again, as quickly as I had before. I shook my head. Pascal's wager never appealed to me. It seems logically shallow. Perhaps because it posits only two choices, said Ania. Somewhere in the desert night, an owl made a short, sharp sound. Spiritual resurrection and immortality, or death and damnation, she said. Those last two aren't the same thing, I said. No, but perhaps to someone like Blaise Pascal they were. Someone terrified of the eternal silence of these infinite spaces. A spiritual agoraphobic, I said. Ania laughed. The sound was so sincere and spontaneous that I could not help loving it. Her. Religion seems to have always offered us that false duality, she said, setting her cup of tea on a flat stone. The silences of infinite space, or the cozy comfort of inner certainty. I made a rude noise. The Pax Church offers a more pragmatic certainty. Ania nodded. That may be its only recourse these days. Perhaps our reservoir of spiritual faith has run out.
Perhaps it should have run out a long time ago, I said sternly. Superstition has taken a terrible toll on our species. Wars, pogroms, resistance to logic and science and medicine. Not to mention gathering power in the hands of people like those who run the packs.
Is all religion superstition then, Rawl? All faith then folly?
I squinted at her. The dim light from inside the shelter and the dimmer starlight outside played on her sharp cheekbones and the gentle curve of her chin. What do you mean? I said, correctly expecting a trap.
If you had faith in me, would that be folly?
Faith in you? How?
I said, hearing my voice sounding suspicious, almost sullen. As a friend or as a messiah?
What's the difference? Asked Ania, smiling again in that way that usually meant a challenge was in the offing.
Faith in a friend is friendship, I said. Loyalty. I hesitated. Love.
And faith in a messiah? Said Ania, her eyes catching the light. I made a brusque throwing away gesture.
That's religion.
But what if your friend is the messiah? She said, smiling openly now.
You mean, what if your friend thinks she's the messiah? I said. I shrugged again. I guess you stay loyal to her and try to keep her out of the asylum.
Ania's smile faded, but I sensed that it was not because of my harsh comment. Her gaze had turned inward. I wish it were that simple, my dear friend.
Touched, filled with a wave of anxiety as real as surging nausea, I said, You are going to tell me why you were chosen as this messiah, kiddo. What makes you the bond between two worlds?
The girl, young woman, I realized, nodded solemnly. I was chosen simply because I was that first child of the core and humankind.
She had said that earlier. I nodded this time. So those are the two worlds which you connect? The core and us?
Two of the worlds, yes, said Ania, looking up at me again. Not the only two. That's precisely what messiahs do, Rawl. Bridge different worlds, different eras, provide the bond between two irreconcilable concepts.
And your connection to both these worlds makes you the messiah? I said again. Ania shook her head quickly, almost impatiently. Something like anger glinted in her eyes.
No, she said sharply. I'm the messiah because of what I can do.
I blinked at her vehemence. What can you do, kiddo?
Ania held out her hand and gently touched me with it. Remember when I said that the church and Pax were right about me, Rawl? That I was a virus?
Uh-huh.
She squeezed my wrist. I can pass that virus, Rawl. I can infect others. Geometric progression. A plague of carriers.
Carriers of what, I said? Messiahhood?
She shook her head. Her expression was so sad that it made me want to console her, put my arms around her. Her grip remained firm on my wrist. No, she said, just the next step in what we are, what we can be.
I took a breath. You talked about teaching the physics of love, I said, of understanding love as a basic force of the universe. Is that the virus? Still holding my wrist, she looked at me a long moment.
That's the source of the virus, she said softly. What I teach is how to use that energy.
How? I whispered. Ania blinked slowly, as if she were the one dreaming and about to awaken.
Let's say there are four steps, she said. Four stages, four levels.
I waited. Her fingers made a loop around my captured wrist.
The first is learning the language of the dead, she said.
What is that?
Shh! Ania had raised the first finger of her free hand to her lips to shush me. The second is learning the language of the living, she said.
I nodded, not understanding either phrase.
The third is hearing the music of the spheres, she whispered.
In my reading at Taliesin West, I had run across this ancient phrase. It was all mixed up with astrology, the pre-scientific age on old Earth. Kepler's little wooden models of a solar system predicated on perfect shapes, shells of stars and planets being moved by angels, volumes of double talk. I had no idea what my friend was talking about and how it could apply to an age when humanity moved faster than light through the spiral arm of the galaxy.
The fourth step, she said, her gaze turned inward again, is learning to take the first step.
The first step? I repeated, confused. You mean the first step you mentioned? What was it, learning the language of the dead?
Ania shook her head, slowly bringing me into focus. It was as if she had been elsewhere for a moment. No, she said. I mean taking the first step.
Almost holding my breath, I said. All right, I'm ready, kiddo. Teach me. Ania smiled again.
That's the irony, Rawl, my love. If I choose to do this, I'll always be known as the one who teaches. But the silly thing is, I don't have to teach it. I only have to share this virus to impart each of these stages to those who wish to learn. I looked down at where her slim fingers encircled a part of my wrist.
"So you've already given me this virus?" I said.
I felt nothing except the usual electric tingle that her touch always created in me. My friend laughed. "No, Rawl, you're not ready. And it takes communion to share the virus, not just contact. And I haven't decided what to do, if I should do this."
"To share with me?"
I said, thinking, "communion?" "To share with everyone," she whispered, serious again. "With everyone ready to learn." She looked directly at me again. Somewhere in the desert, a coyote was yipping. "These levels, stages, can't coexist with a cruciform, Rawl."
"So the born-again can't learn?" I said. "This would rule out the vast majority of human beings."
She shook her head. "They can learn. They just can't stay born again. The cruciform has to go." I let out my breath.
I did not understand most of this, but that's because it seemed to be double talk.
"Don't all would-be messiahs speak double talk?" asked the cynical part of me in Grand Dame's level voice.
Aloud, I said, "There's no way to remove a cruciform without killing the person wearing it, the true death."
I had always wondered if this fact had been the main reason I had been unwilling to go under the cross, or perhaps it was just my youthful belief in my own immortality.
Ania did not respond directly. She said,
"You like the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix people, don't you?" Blinking, I tried to understand this. Had I dreamed that phrase? Those people, that pain? Wasn't I dreaming now, or was this a memory of a real conversation? But Ania knew nothing of Demria, Demloa, and the others. The night and stone and canvas shelter seemed to ripple like a shredding dreamscape.
"I like them," I said, feeling my friend remove her fingers from my wrist.
Wasn't my wrist shackled to the headboard?
Ania nodded and sipped her cooling tea.
"There's hope for the Spectrum Helix people, and for all the thousands of other cultures which have reverted or sprung up since the fall. The hegemony meant homogeneity, Rawl. The Pax means even more. The human genome, the human soul, distrusts homogeneity, Rawl. They are always ready to take a chance, to risk change and diversity."
"Ania," I said, reaching for her, "I don't... we can't." There was a terrible sense of falling, and the dreamscape came apart like thin cardboard in a hard rain. I could not see my friend.
"Wake up, Rawl. They are coming for you. The Pax is coming."
I tried to awaken, groping toward consciousness like a sluggish machine crawling uphill. But the weight of fatigue and the painkillers kept dragging me down. I did not understand why Ania wanted me awake. We were conversing so well in the dream.
"Wake up, Rawl Endymion."
"Wake up, Rawl Endymion." It was not Ania. Even before I was fully awake and focused, I recognized the soft voice and thick dialect of Demria. I sat straight up. The woman was undressing me. I realized that she had pulled the loose nightshirt off and was tugging my undershirt on. Cleaned and smelling of fresh breezes now, but unmistakably my undershirt. My undershorts were already on. My twill pants, overshirt, and vest were laid across the bottom of the bed. How had she done this with the handcuff on my... I stared at my wrist. The handcuffs were lying open on the bedclothes. My arm tingled painfully as circulation returned. I licked my lips and tried to speak without slurring. "The Pax? Coming?" Demria pulled my shirt on as if I were her child, Bin, or younger. I motioned her hands away and tried to close the buttons with suddenly awkward fingers. They had used buttons rather than seal tabs at Taliesin West on old Earth. I thought I had grown used to them, but this was taking forever.
"And we heard on the radio that a dropship had landed at Bombacino. There are 4 people in unknown uniforms, 2 men, 2 women. They were asking the Commandant about you. They just lifted off. The dropship and 3 skimmers. They will be here in 4 minutes, perhaps less.
Radio? I said stupidly. I thought you said that the radio didn't work. Isn't that why the priest went to the base to get the doctor?
Father Clifton's radio was not working, whispered Demaria, pulling me to my feet. She held me steady as I stepped into my trousers. We have radios, tight beam transmitters, satellite relays, all of which the Pax knows nothing about, and spies in place. One has warned us. Hurry, Rawl and Dimion. The ships will be here in a minute.
I came fully awake then, literally flushed with a surge of anger and hopelessness that threatened to wash me away. Why won't these bastards leave me alone? 4 people in unknown uniforms. Pax, obviously. Evidently their search for Ania, Abetic, and me had not ended when the priest captain, DeSoya, had let us escape the trap on God's Grove more than 4 years earlier. I looked at the chronometer readout on my comm log. The ships would be landing in a minute or so. There was nowhere I could run in that time where Pax troopers would not find me. Let me go, I said, pulling away from the short woman in the blue robe. The window was open, the afternoon breeze coming through the curtains. I imagined that I could hear the near ultrasonic hum of skimmers. I have to get away from your house. I had images of the Pax torching the home with young Cess Ambry and Bin still in it. Demaria pulled me back from the window. At that moment, the man of the household, young Alem Mikhail Demalem, came in with Demloa. They were carrying the Lusian bulk of the Pax trooper who had been left to guard me. Cess Ambry, her dark eyes bright, was lifting the guard's feet while Bin struggled to pull one of the man's huge boots off. The Lusian was fast asleep, mouth open, drool moistening the high collar of his combat fatigues. I looked at Demaria.
Demloa brought him some tea about 15 minutes ago, she said softly. She made a graceful gesture that caused the blue sleeve of her robe to billow. I am afraid that we use the rest of your ultramorph prescription, Roland Dimion.
I have to go, I began. The ache in my back was bearable, but my legs were shaky.
No, said Demaria. They will catch you within minutes.
She pointed to the window. From outside there came the unmistakable subsonic rumble of a dropship on EM drive, followed by the thud and bark of its thrusters. The thing must be hovering right above the village, seeking a landing site. A second later, the window vibrated to a triple sonic boom, and 2 black skimmers banked above the adobe buildings next door. Alem Mikhail had stripped the Lusian to his thermal weave underwear and had laid him out on the bed. Now he snapped the man's massive right wrist into the handcuffs and snicked the other cuff around the headboard bar. Demloa and Cess Ambry were sweeping up the layers of fatigue clothing, body armor, and huge boots and stuffing them in a laundry bag. Little Bin Rhea Demloa Alem tossed the guard's helmet in the bag. The thin boy was carrying the heavy flechette pistol. I started at the sight. Children and weapons was a mix I learned to avoid even when I was a child myself, learning to handle power weapons while our caravan rumbled its way across the Hyperion moors. But Alem smiled and took the pistol from the boy, patting him on the back. It was obvious from the way Bin had held the weapon, fingers away from the trigger guard, pointing the muzzle away from himself and his father, checking the safety indicator even as he gave the pistol up, that he had handled such a device before. Bin smiled at me, took the heavy bag with the guard's clothing in it, and ran out of the room. The noise outside rose to a crescendo, and I turned to look out the window. A black skimmer kicked up dust less than 30 meters down the street that ran along the canal. I could see it through a gap between the houses. The larger dropship lowered itself out of sight to the south, probably landing in the grassy open area near the well where I had collapsed in pain from the kidney stone. I had just finished wiggling into my boots and securing my vest when Alem handed me the flechette pistol. I checked the safety and propellant charge indicators out of habit, but then shook my head. No, I said. It would be suicide to attack Pax troopers with just this. Their armor. I was not actually thinking about their armor at that moment, but rather about the return fire from assault weapons that would level this house in an instant. I thought of the boy outside with a laundry bag of trooper's armor.
"Bin," I said, "if they catch him."
We know," said Demria, pulling me away from the bed and into the narrow hallway. I did not remember this part of the house. My universe for the past 40-some hours had been the bedroom and adjoining lavatory. "Come, come," she said. I pulled away again, handing the pistol to Alem.
"Just let me run," I said, my heart pounding. I gestured toward the snoring Lusian. "They won't think that's me for a second. They can tight-beam the doctor. If she's not already in one of those skimmers, to ID me. Just tell them..." I looked at the friendly faces in their blue robes. "Tell them that I overpowered the guard and held you at gunpoint." I stopped then, realizing that the guard would destroy that cover story as soon as he awoke. The family's complicity in my escape would be self-evident. I looked at the flechette pistol again, half ready to reach for it. One burst of steel needles and the sleeping trooper would never awaken to destroy the cover-up and endanger these good people. Only I could never do it. I might shoot a Pax trooper in a fair fight. Indeed, the adrenaline rush of anger that was burning through my weakness and terror told me that it would be a welcome relief to have that opportunity. But I could never shoot this sleeping man. But there would be no fair fight. Pax troopers in combat armor, much less these mysterious four in the dropship, Swiss Guard, would be immune to flechettes and anything else short of Pax assault weapons, and the Swiss Guard would be immune to those. I was screwed. These good people who had shown me such kindness were screwed. A rear door slammed open and Bin slid into the hallway, his robe hiked up to show spindly legs covered with dust. I stared at him, thinking that the boy would not get his cruciform and would die of cancer. The adults might well spend the next standard decade in a Pax prison. "I'm sorry," I said, hunting for words. I could hear the commotion in the street as troopers hurried through the evening rush of pedestrians. "Rol and Dimion," said Dem Loa in her soft voice, handing me the rucksack they had brought for my kayak. "Please shut up and follow us. At once." There was a tunnel entrance beneath the floor of the hallway. I had always thought that hidden passages were the stuff of old hollow dramas, but I followed Demria into this one willingly enough. We were a strange procession, Demria and Dem Loa sweeping down the steep staircase ahead of me, then me carrying the flechette pistol and fumbling the rucksack on my back, then little Bin followed by his sister Cess Ambry, then carefully locking the trap door behind him. Alem Mikhail Dem Alem. No one stayed behind. The house was empty except for the snoring Lusian trooper. The stairway went deeper than a normal basement level, and at first I thought that the walls were adobe like the ones above. Then I realized that the passage was cut from a soft stone, perhaps sandstone. 27 steps and we reached the bottom of the vertical shaft, and Demria led the way down a narrow passage, illuminated by pale chemical glow globes. I wondered why this average, working-class home would have an underground passage. As if reading my mind, Dem Loa's blue cowl turned and she whispered, "The Amoyeti Spectrum Helix demands, discreet entrances to one another's homes, especially during the twice darkness." "Twice darkness?" I whispered back, ducking under one of the globes. We had already gone 20 or 25 meters, away from the canal river, I thought, and the passage still curved out of sight to the right. "The slow dual eclipse of the sun by this world's two moons," whispered Dem Loa. "It lasts precisely 19 minutes. It is the primary reason that we chose this world. Please excuse the pun." "Ah," I said. I did not understand, but it didn't seem to matter at that moment. "Pax troops have sensors to find spider holes like this," I whispered to the women in front of me. "They have deep radar to search through rock. They have..." "Yes, yes," said Alem from behind me. "But they will be held up a few minutes by the mayor and the others."
"The mayor?" I repeated rather stupidly. My legs were still weak from the 2 days in bed and pain. My back and groin ached, but it was a minor pain, inconsequential, compared to what I had passed through and what had passed through me during the last couple of days.
"The mayor is challenging the Pax's right to search," whispered Demria.
The passage widened and went straight for at least 100 meters. We passed 2 branching tunnels. This wasn't a bolt hole, it was a bloody catacombs. "The Pax recognizes the mayor's authority in Lochchild Lamond," she whispered. The silken robes of the 5 family members in blue were also whispering against the sandstone as we hurried down the passage. "We still have law and courts on Vitus, Grey, Balianus B, so they are not allowed unlimited search and seizure rights."
"But they'll download permission from whatever authority they need," I said, hurrying to keep up with the women. We came to another juncture and they turned right.
"Eventually," said Demloa. "But the streets are now filled with all of the colors of the Lochchild Lamond strand of the Helix. Reds, whites, greens, ebonies, yellows. Thousands of people from our village. And many more are coming from nearby locks. No one will volunteer which house is the one where you are kept. Father Clifton has been lured out of town on a ruse, so he can be of no help to the Pax troopers. Dr. Molina has been detained in Karoa Tambat by some of our people and is currently out of touch with her Pax superiors, and your guard will be sleeping for at least another hour. This way." We turned left into a wider passage, stopped at the first door we had seen, waited for Demria to palm-lock it open, and then stepped into a large, echoing space carved into the stone. We were standing on a metal stairway looking down on what appeared to be a subterranean garage. 6 long, slim vehicles with oversized wheels, stern wings, sails, and pedals clustered by primary colors. These things were like buckboards set on spidery suspensions, obviously powered by wind and muscle power, and covered over with wood, bright, silky polymer fabrics, and perspex. "Wind cycles," said Cess Ambry.
Several men and women in emerald-green robes and high boots were preparing 3 of the wagons for departure. Lashed in the back of one of the long wagon beds was my kayak. Everyone was moving down the clattering staircase, but I stopped at the head of the stairs. My balking was so sudden that poor Bin and Cess Ambry almost crashed into me.
"What is it?" said Alem Mikhail.
I had tucked the flechette pistol in my belt, and now I opened my hands.
"Why are you doing this? Why is everyone helping? What's going on?"
Demria took a step back up the metal staircase and leaned on the railing. Her eyes were as bright as her daughter's had been.
"If they take you, Rolandimian, they will kill you."
"How do you know?" I said. My voice was soft, but the acoustics of the underground garage were such that the men and women in green looked up from where they were working below.
"You spoke in your sleep," said Demloa.
I cocked my head, not understanding. I had been dreaming of Ania and our conversation. What would that have told these people?
Demria took another step upward and touched my wrist with her cool hand.
"The Amoyeti Spectrum Helix has foretold this woman, Rolandimian, this one named Ania. We call her the one who teaches."
I felt goosebumps at that moment in the chill glow-globe light of this buried place. The old poet, Uncle Martin, had spoken of my young friend as a messiah, but his cynicism leaked into everything he said or did. The people of Taliesin West had respected Ania, but to believe that the energetic 16-year-old was actually a world historical figure, it seemed unlikely, and the girl and I had spoken of it in real life and in my ultramorph dreams, but, my God, I was on a world scores of light-years away from Hyperion and an eternal distance from the lesser Magellanic Cloud where old Earth was hidden. How had these people?
"Halpul Amoyeti knew of the one who teaches when he composed the Helix Symphony," said Demloa.